Alale, 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 alale.
Hey everyone, welcome to Big Blend Radio's Vacation Station Travel Writer Show with the International Food, Wine, and Travel Writers Association. We call them IFTWA, and you can go to their website, ifwtwa.org. They're an awesome way to connect writers and photographers with the actual destinations, and we love doing these shows because you never know where we're going to go, but today we're going to Africa with award-winning travel writer and photographer Jamie Edwards. She's a publisher of luxury travel notes. On her site, iamlostandfound.com. When you go on her website, you're going to be stuck there for the rest of the day. So fair warning. So welcome to the show, Jamie. How are you?
Thank you. Very happy to be here and talk about one of my favorite places on earth.
Africa, I know. It's like they say that, you know, once you touch the soil, that little bit of soil gets under your fingernails and it never leaves. And you just want to keep going back home to the motherland. You know, it's the motherland, I believe, you know.
Absolutely.
It is. Africa is amazing. And what's really cool is you've been from, you've done Cape to Cairo pretty much, right?
We over the past 20 years have been lucky enough to get to Africa four or five times. I've been to five countries: Morocco, South Africa, Botswana, Uganda. It's just been, and each one has been really unique to one another, and each one I would go back to in a heartbeat.
Oh, me too. I know we were talking a little bit of South Africa, which is where we lived before we came home to the States, and Nancy had a magazine over there, and then we said, oh, we'll never do that, it's so much work. It didn't take long for us to be back doing exactly what we belong doing, which is, you know, magazines and now podcasting. But you know, South Africa is amazing. You went to Uganda. So we were near there when we were in Kenya, and but you went and saw the silverbacks. I mean, that is a bucket list for everybody, I think, you know.
It's definitely one of the things I tell people when they say, where should I go when I go to Africa? I don't know if I would recommend Uganda as your first experience in Africa. I would tend to send someone to South Africa or Botswana. Especially for Southern Africa. Uganda, I think, would be a phase two, although it doesn't have to be, depending on your travel style. If you really want to get off the beaten path on your first experience in Africa, Uganda is an incredible place to go. What I think some people don't know about tracking the silverbacks is that you go all this way to Uganda, and each permit you buy only allows you 1 hour with the silverbacks. And so if you think about having two treks, two permits over the course of your time there, you're talking about 2 hours in your entire trip devoted to the silverbacks, at least the actual viewing of them. And so there is so much else to be done in Uganda. There's Queen Ashasha National Park, where you can see the climbing lions. And those are, I believe, the only place in the world you can see climbing lions. So it's important to realize that there's a lot of other things you'll want to do to fill your time aside from the magnificent silverbacks.
Well, I think you bring up something really important because, you know, being raised in Kenya and South Africa, everyone is like the big five. And I'm like, dudes, I mean, even impala, or, I mean, I've got zebras behind me because I kind of miss zebras. And, you know, I do. And everything to me, it's like the birds, you were talking about the turacos in one of your articles. And I'm like, oh, we used to have those in our backyard. Like, you know, I was really lucky. Like, seriously.
Well, the birds, you were there when you were young, and I'm impressed that the birds excite you, because I tell this story. My husband and I went on our first trip to Africa for our honeymoon, and it was actually a surprise honeymoon. I didn't know where I was going until we got to the airport, and
we
went to Tanzania, and we flew all across the world from Washington. We were living in New York at the time, and we were in a Jeep with another couple behind us. We were in our late 20s. The couple behind us in the Jeep were in their probably 40s or 50s. And they were ticking off the birds on their
Oh, the
list.
birders, yeah.
And we were laughing like, birds, what are they kidding? Like, we're here to see lions and we're here to see leopards. Well, fast forward when we take our kids 20 years later and we are the ones ticking off the birds. I think that there is something about a maturity that needs to be involved where you appreciate each of these beautiful gems of birds when you travel as much as the big five.
Oh, and Africa, I mean, just even lilac-breasted rollers and, just the cranes and, all of these, just, oh man, I'm just thinking like the secretary birds and, the shoebills. You saw shoebills and
I did.
so
I went to
seriously.
Uganda with a girlfriend of mine, and we had split up for the first part of the trip because she had some work to do in Entebbe. And I went to the Mbaba swamp, and that's where the elusive shoebill lives. And I went out on a rickety old boat with the guide, and he had said that you just don't see them all that often. So I was prepared to not see the shoebill, which is I call it the most beautiful ugly bird on earth. It's worth Googling what it looks like. But we did see one, and even our guide was mesmerized by it. We sat with it for 20, 30 minutes.
Oh.
And that's the thing about Africa that I always say, no matter where you go in Africa, especially when wildlife is concerned, anything can happen at any given moment. And that is part of the incredible excitement around Africa.
Do you, just the way I was raised was actually out in the bush and you become incredibly observant and you start seeing animals like other people wouldn't just not see them. And we find that in this country too, going to national parks or parks, forests, I've watched people walk right by deer and not see the deer. And I'm like, dudes, you miss them. There's a little baby, a little fawn, and you just walk right by a fawn and her mommy. How did you miss this? And I think Africa really taught us like observancy, like even when we're driving somewhere, we'll see something and think it's something and it's not because we're always like looking for birds, wildlife. I don't care what it is, but even if it's not there, we'll find
I agree with you. I think that there is something that makes you become inherently more observant while you're in the bush. And I think a lot of that has to do with there not being a lot of other distractions. The sounds you're more in
Oh,
tune
yeah.
to because you're not hearing planes overhead. And of course, you have your guides who are. They're such experts in discovering and knowing how to find these animals, not just based upon their habits, which of course they know, but for instance, when I was in Uganda, also our guide had looked up in the sky and saw some birds circling in a certain area. He knew that was over a particular lake, and he had heard earlier that a hyena had been spotted near there. So he
Oh.
put all of those things together in his mind and had a gut feeling. And of course we go out there and there's a pack of hyenas eating an animal. And we just all of those cues that he was able to spot led us to be able to witness that. And I think that that is such a beautiful thing that the intelligence surrounding their craft.
Yeah, you get to know animals' habits, and birders know you hear a bird before you see the bird. And oftentimes you're checking them off and you still can't see them, or, it's really hard to even photograph them. Like, don't even, like here in this country, me and bluebirds, man, they have me chasing them everywhere and I suck at, I don't know, whatever it is, it's just not happening with the photos and bluebirds, but
It's so
everything else,
hard.
I know. And they look at you like, ha ha. It's like they know, but yeah, I mean, it's just, the wilds of Africa are still wild. It's nice to hear, growing up there and watching things develop in this country. I'm finding it very difficult to take photos without human interference, even in our national parks. Like you're saying, it could be here's chemical trails from airplanes. It could be airplanes going over, helicopters, and even the Grand Canyon. They're trying to limit some of that because you can't. It just it does ruin it. And humans, and we do a lot of trash. Let's just put that out. I don't care where it is. It's us humans are pretty bad. And so even some of the areas, you know, there's some of the public land is shared with mining and oil derricks. And I mean, it's kind of this weird balance that we have in this country. And I almost feel like our representatives need to go to Africa to learn something and come back, right? And yet mm-hmm. we're the ones who started the national park system.
Agreed. It's true. And I think that when we were talking earlier, before you started recording, we were talking about the differences between, say, South Africa going on safari and a place mm-hmm. like Botswana. And Ooh. One of the things I think is that a place like Botswana, it seems like there's less tourism, or it's just that the delta is so large and vast that you aren't on top of other tourists all the time, which also I think is a wonderful thing as far as someone who might be thinking about where to go on safari or take their family. Some of the game parks in South Africa tend to be, and you know better, very controlled and crowded. But you go out into the Okavango Delta of Botswana and you could just travel for hours and hours in one direction and not see another vehicle.
Yeah, we used to see like a leopard or something, right? Or even a kill. And then everyone's like, ew, but I'm like, this is part of nature, and to see a kill happen is pretty exciting, right? And then you hear them, and you talked about that in one of your, the crunch of, you know, and I'm like, yep. Even here in the not the Okavango swamp. Now I'm like, I went to Africa completely. The Okefenokee swamp.
Oh,
and
sure.
that was a goal for me as a kid in Africa. That was a bucket list destination, was the Okefenokee swamp. And now we've been twice. And the last time we were there, there was this massive alligator chomping on a turtle or a tortoise. And you could just hear this crunch. And I was like, ooh. And then like, I almost got nailed by a cottonmouth. So I thought, this was the best day ever. I'm like photographing cottonmouth, and he's all like, oh yeah. And I'm like, oh, maybe I don't want to do this. I think I better stand back, you know.
Well, it's important to be respectful of nature and of wildlife, yeah. especially. And I think that being on any of these trips, whether it's in the U.S. at national parks or anywhere else in the world, we're invading their territory. We are the ones behind bars in the zoo, for lack of a better word. We are observing them in their habitat. And there's always risk involved, but the adventure and what you're talking about, like the excitement around it for certain people, and I'm one of those people, I could sit for 2 hours watching a kill. And I think that that is something else people don't maybe realize about taking their kids on safari or on a trip of this nature, is there's a certain age that a child just cannot be patient and sit still to observe wildlife. So I personally, my husband and I decided that we were going to wait until our youngest child was at least 11 or 12. Because we wanted it to be a memorable experience, and we wanted to have both of our kids be able to understand the patience involved. There's a lot of time between finding one animal and another. There's so much involved patience-wise. So I think that that is a big factor when people
ask. And it's tiring. Driving on those roads, at the end of the day, you do want a cocktail or some wine. And that was the thing, you know, but I want to go back to when you're in a busy park. So this is, you know, I don't know how it is GPS and all that out there now, but back in the day, like if you stop, people want to, here comes everybody. They stopped. What are they looking at? So we'd pull out a map and look like we're just planning our next route. So we would just be very obvious. We'd like the whole front of the car or Jeep would be like, this is our map. So there's nothing here. And they'd drive by and we'd have that animal all to ourselves. But it is also about, you know, because some of the Jeeps would get too close, and that was back in the day, but in the 70s and 80s, you know, and you've got to have some breathing space. And I think we've gotten better over the years. And Africa is really working hard on the poaching. They really, you know, and so many, you know, conservation organizations are doing good on that. And I think when people travel to Africa and experience these different wild places and have that experience of all these different creatures, whether it's an animal or a bird, right? or going through a swamp or, you know, going out in the true Bosveld and seeing like the acacia trees and the sunset or Mount Kilimanjaro, all these amazing places, and meet the people, which are just these resilient, vibrant humans, you know, and their cultural just vibrancy, right? And so when you go there, then hopefully you go, oh, you know what? We do want to do things to prevent poaching and wildlife trafficking. And I think it, you know, this kind of tourism can help us as humans understand the world is a big place, man. And we're just this little thing, but we can make positive differences, even.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, my daughter, who is now 19, spent a gap year between high school and college. And part of her gap year was spent rehabilitating animals who had been left behind because their parents had been poached. And it's there is so much that we can do if we're interested to help. And that definitely made me enthusiastic about the possibility in the future of going back to Africa, not just as a spectator, but as someone who more towards voluntourism. And that would be because I'm so in love with Africa and everything about Africa, that's where I'd like to go. It's for someone like me who loves wildlife, loves photographing wildlife, that's sort of a natural fit. But I think that there's something for everyone in Africa. And even beyond safaris, you have places like Morocco, the Atlas Mountains, and other parts that of northern Africa that are vibrant and unique and exciting in a completely different way.
Yeah, exactly. And when, you know, what got you started actually in travel and then becoming a travel writer and photographer?
It's sort of become the second life for me. I started out my career in design and advertising in New York. I spent 20 years working at advertising agencies and graphic design firms. And then my husband had an opportunity to move to Tokyo. So we left New York for 4 years. We brought our two kids to Tokyo and had a wonderful time exploring. We had already had the travel bug. My husband and I were already big travelers. So we looked at this Tokyo experience as a way to really get under Southeast Asia and explore it, which we did. And then when we moved back to the United States, where we live in DC, a girlfriend of mine had said that people are always asking you advice on travel. Where should I go to have dinner in Buenos Aires? Where do you recommend a hotel in Iceland? So she said, why don't you put it all together in a blog? And since I wasn't working anymore and my kids were a bit older, I spent a year putting it together and launched it. And my goal is really to inspire travel, tell stories about where I've been from a firsthand point of view. So rather than me saying, Lisa, you should go to Botswana because of XYZ, instead I tell my story about Botswana and hope that it encourages someone to go there on their own.
Yeah, you do have a sense of place reading your writing, and your site is beautiful. You've just obviously come from a design background, right? But also know how to be a storyteller in that you've got a really good balance of inspiration. So people are excited. I think that sometimes we get so detail oriented as travel writers where it's almost like, here's the list of things, which, you know, that's fine. Mm-hmm. And it's helpful, but there's got to be that excitement of, you know, planning it for yourself too, or getting help doing it and going there and going somewhere completely unknown. You know what I mean?
So people assume that because I'm very detail oriented, that means I have everything planned. Oftentimes our style of travel is to only plan a few things, whether it's a restaurant we can't wait to go to.
Get the permit for the silverbacks.
Well, absolutely. You have to do that in advance. That is a given. But then to leave some things to chance and to explore and to just sit at a cafe on a square and watch the world go by instead of having every hour planned with a museum or a specific place to go. That's just not our travel style. And it works for us to have a little bit leisure time built in.
Well, you're soaking up the area. You know, it's like, you know, as we travel, we're pet sitting. So we're actually really getting to know what it's like to live in these places as we travel.
Oh,
and
that's interesting.
So it's a slow form of travel. Though I think over COVID, we did like 1,500 parks. So that was a little crazy. But hey,
I like
quiet.
Slow travel. Slow travel is a great concept.
It is, because it's like, if you have, when you have like this to-do list, it's almost becomes a chore when you're traveling. And I don't think you're soaking up an area very well if you're just checking off, like, you know, like the bird list is cool. That's investigative, cool stuff, right? That's a treasure hunt. But when it comes to like checking off every little thing, I think we miss things. And I think travel writing, it used to be a no-no about writing from a personal perspective. And then blogs opened up and said, hey, move on over. And getting blogs to be something important, it just personality won over the muckety mucks, basically, of what should be in travel writing, you know?
Yes, I agree with that. And I think oftentimes some of the feedback I get is, you made me feel like I was there.
Nice.
Or you make me feel like I want to go there. And in my mind, both of those are wins. That's all I really, I love that.
And restaurants can come and go, places change. But if you have a good narrative of something personal, then that doesn't change. That's, you know, history. That is something that is, ooh, I want that feeling, because that's what you're out when you're traveling, is to have experienced something new, you know? So it's evergreen in a way, you know, and it's creative too, to be able to put someone in that space. And, you know, it, like when you're on safari, if you don't feel that dirt and know what it's like to have a horsefly get you, like, you haven't been on a safari, you know? It's like,
it's true. In fact, anyone who knows me knows that I value my sleep. I'm a big sleeper. I love to get a good night's sleep. And there's very little I would sacrifice for a great night's sleep. But I, ever since our very first night in a tent or a lodge in Africa, all I really want to do is stay up all night to listen to the sound.
Oh my gosh. Hyenas at night. I tell people there is nothing like the woo, you know, of a hyena at night, you know.
There's nothing like it. In fact, I try my hardest to stay awake. One of the most exciting experiences I had, aside from hearing the lions roaring in the distance, which
amazing.
Is otherworldly.
Yeah.
One of the best experiences was when we were at a tent in Botswana, and they had what they called their resident elephant, who would wander around. And we had canvas sides to our tent. It was like a permanent structure, but it was a tent. And in the night, I heard this low padding of feet walking past, and I heard the elephant scrape against the side of the tent, and I held my breath. It was such a beautiful sound. It was so slow and beautiful. And I just, all I want to do is hear more sounds like that. That is my draw to get
it's
me
a
back
connection.
Back.
Yeah. You know, we did an interview about a documentary called Elephant Refugees. And it was about a resort in Botswana, and they were going through a drought, and these elephants were dying, like literally, in wildlife around them. Cause it just, and when we talk about drought in this country, I'm like, dude, I've lived through droughts, and it's like you're not allowed to drink water kind of things. I mean, real ones. I mean, I remember in South Africa having to pay a deposit on a bathtub stopper because they were measuring your water, and you could only have like an inch of water in your bathtub.
That's incredible.
And, you know, so it was a really big deal. And seeing out in nature, it's devastating. And it was devastating what was happening to these elephants in this resort. And they're like, okay, we need tourism to survive. And if we don't survive, the elephants don't have water. So this catch 22 position that they were in, and the elephants were going in and opening toilets and getting water. And I mean, they were shipping water in. This family just worked so hard for these elephants, right? And then people camped And the elephants would come at night for water, drain the swimming pool. And they're like, well, we shouldn't have the swimming pool because of the water situation. But then the people want the swimming pool. So you don't get the tur it's like this mess, right? So
Yes.
I encourage you to watch this, but
Oh, I
at
would love to.
night, yeah, free it, yeah, elephant refugees. I'll make sure it, everyone watch it. Anyway, the elephants at night would go around, get whatever water they could do, but people are in like little tents, right? We're not talking about the glamping style like you're talking about, right? And the elephants walked around the tents, never crushed over them. And we're talking like a whole bunch of them
Wow.
in between the tents in the morning, and people would hear what you're talking about. And I'm getting goosebumps because I remember bats and monkeys and all kinds of things coming up in tents and yeah, snakes, all of it. But
I mean,
anyhow,
that is
we
the
don't scare
excitement
people.
of it,
Yeah.
being in it. It's like being inside the Discovery Channel, just
But they
being.
have this respect for you. You know, they
Yes.
respect, I mean, for them to do that. Now, have you done watering holes at night?
No,
Oh,
it's on my
no
list.
way. Oh, you got to go to Kenya because, like, this is the coolest thing. And I think it was called Treetops. And I don't know if it's still there or not. But as a little girl, like, you would, there was like a bar. So, you know, if people are having cocktails and watching the wildlife come to the watering hole,
Wow.
elephants, leopards, lions, you name it. You know, all come to the watering hole and you're watching at night. Seriously, you need to do that. And you're
Well,
in a
I'll talk to my
treehouse.
husband.
Getting look up,
We
we have
have
to look
some.
up treetops and see if it's still there. I don't know. It's in the
Well,
Abadirs.
Kenya's definitely on our list. And I mean, it really would, as I mentioned earlier too, it's something I'm looking forward to doing after my kids are both out of the house.
Yeah.
To go to Africa, spend time a month at a time working in different places, whether it be with the silverbacks, for instance. One of the things I was most impressed with Uganda, and oftentimes people have asked me, why did I choose Uganda over Rwanda? Because the silverbacks,
Everyone thinks Rwanda immediately, or
pardon?
so everyone thinks of Rwanda immediately.
They do. They think of Rwanda because they were sort of first with the tourism around the silverbacks. So, for people who don't know, so, and I didn't know this until I researched it, silverback gorillas are in no zoos around the world. There are none in captivity. The only place you could see them in the entire world is the parks that sort of are at the corners of Congo, Uganda, and Rwanda. So that's really the area that they are in the world. And Rwanda was on the map first when it came to tourism for the silverbacks. Their permits are much more expensive. I think when I went to Uganda, at the time, the Rwanda permits were $1,500 a trek. So we're talking about $1,500 for that one
1 hour.
experience. And in Uganda, it was half the price. Also, we chose Uganda because it seemed a little bit more off the beaten path. As far as tourism went, it wasn't as pretty and buttoned up as Rwanda was. And we had this amazing experience where, so the Bwindi Impenetrable National Park is where the silverbacks are, the families live. And they're habituated, which means that they are accustomed to seeing humans. You can't get close to them, but they're not, going to lash out at you unless you, of course, are. You know, coming for them or going towards their babies. They're used to humans. And I think one of the most incredible things I learned about this and going back to your slow travel, my friend and I were discouraged because when we got our permits, we discovered that the only permits we could get were for an entrance to the park that was 2 hours away from where our hotel was. And our hotel was in the park, near of 5 minutes away from a different entrance. So we had to travel 2 hours to a different entrance, even though we had one literally on our doorstep, just because of the way that the flow of tourism could go. So we woke up at 5 in the morning to get to the Ruhiga entrance by 7. It was the most beautiful drive. We saw the sunrise over the tea fields. We saw people working. We went through towns. We saw kids on the road. An experience we never would have had had we gone 5 minutes from our hotel into the entrance of the park. It reminded me that that was a happy accident. Something we thought we were going to dread, a 2 hour Jeep ride at 5 a.m., turned out to be a highlight of our trip. So it just goes to show that travel is not perfect. It shouldn't be. And oftentimes those imperfections become these wonderful experiences.
I agree. That just the same thing happened. We go to the Sequoias a lot, Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks in Central California, and cover them a lot every month, actually. And you can stay in the park. And with us, with our work and podcasting, everything, we're like, okay, we want to do that. But like, what do we do with our stuff? It's like a mess for us sometimes the way we travel, right? So anyway, we stayed in one of the neighboring towns. There's Visalia, there's Three Rivers. Three Rivers is right at the entrance of Sequoia National Park. We've done both. But to get into the actual thing, to the top where the big sequoias are, takes like an hour almost, and like an hour and a half, I think, from Visalia, the city. But Nan, you know, we're one of those that I want to see the sunrise. I'm always like, we have to be there at dawn and dusk. That's when you see the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And I swear, I remember that first time Nancy and I were driving up into the sequoias. I'm wondering if they had it open or closed. But anyway, we got in and we're winding our way up the foothills. So we don't really see what's going on too much in the foothills. We get to the top and we're seeing the sun come up like you wouldn't believe. And it was just like, oh man, over this whole valley. We get into the giant forest and the temperature just drops, right? And it's like, because you're up in the top, you're in the Sierras, and these, you know, jaw dropped, like these trees are massive, you know? And we drive in slowly and lo and behold, there's a bear right there.
Wow.
And I'm like, all right. And then we went towards, like, I think it was some picnic area. I think one of us had to go to the bathroom or something. There's a bear. And I'm like, dude, like if we... Like, what would we have gotten up as early? Yeah, probably. But you know what I mean? Like, when things are too convenient,
yes,
you don't understand how things work in an area.
Yeah. You knew, though, you knew that the wildlife, maybe not everybody knows this, but which is why early morning game drives and those dusk game drives are so important. And the animals are always resting during the day and sleeping.
Yeah. Now, besides animals, right? Because I'll talk about animals all day long. You'll never pull me out of it. Let's talk about food and lodging. Africa, to me, I mean, I don't care if you're tenting it or you are like the resorts. I don't know. They have this. I've never experienced anything like it in anywhere else in the world. There's something magical about them. They understand the connection to nature. Even if you're staying in the city, there's this connection with mm-hmm. where you're staying. Clean hospitality is second to none. I mean, I think they really understand tourism. Like, really.
They do. They really do. And they always seem to get it right. And it's always in the details. I mean, the trackers and the guides are such experts in their field that you feel trust immediately. I've never had an experience where I didn't trust our tracker, our driver, our guide. But as far as the service in the hotels, it must just be built in the way that it feels familial when you go to any of these places. And I think also there's this built-in community of like-minded people who go to these places in the first place, that everybody is sitting around with your guides at night, swapping stories about what you saw that day, who saw a kill, who saw a herd of elephants, who saw a leopard in a tree. Everybody wants to share their stories and their photos. So I think that is all built into the nature of a trip like this to begin with. And then you layer on top of it how you don't really need much in the bush. You need a pair of binoculars. You need a bed. Oftentimes, you slide into bed at night and there's a hot water bottle by your feet that's already toasty.
Oh man, I haven't had one of those since we lived there.
I try to recreate that at home. It's just not the same. But there's so many little touches. One place we went to in Botswana, this small camp had watercolors and an easel. They had a wine area that you could go down and pick any bottle of wine you wanted. And these were not over the top places. These were simple places. But every single touch and detail made sense.
And there's nothing like dining in the bush. Like on these Jeep tours, a lot of them, and I think half my Facebook friends are tour guides. And they're always showing like, here it is. All right. It's lunchtime. They set up, you know, under a tree kind of thing. Make sure there's no mambas in the tree or boomslangs or whatever. And they set up like here and you're going to have a little wine. And next thing you know, this whole meal comes out. Like how it's insane. I remember Nancy talking about this and I was a kid, so I wasn't allowed to imbibe, you know, we're in Kenya, Mombasa, and they would come with a rum drink in a pineapple. And they would come and they were like, here, and go away. And next thing you know, they'd come back with the second one. Like how it was like just this, I don't know. And it, like you're saying, it wasn't over the top.
I think part of it too is that it's so unlike anything we can experience here in our normal lives. It's as different as being on the moon. It's just such a different world.
I want to go to Africa instead. Thank you.
Yeah, same.
I don't care about this moon propagation thing.
I think, though, that that's, it's so unique and so otherworldly that that is part of why everything about it is so, to use an overused word, magical. It's just the sounds are different. The stars are different. The sky is dark, dark, unlike anything I see in my city life. And I know that I appreciate it. I appreciate all of it. I appreciate being able to have a sundowner over the Delta, watching hippos pop their heads up and just realize how visual this is.
Oh, seeing the hippos. Seriously.
They are that, scary.
Just to be able to, I know. Nancy got charged by one.
They are, I think, aren't they the most, those in the
they haul.
Water buffalo are the most dangerous.
Yeah. Yeah. She was, that's when she worked for Joy Adamson, and Joy Adamson's like, here, go. And he had a really weird way of teaching you about wildlife. It's like, here, let's really scare the crap out of you. Nancy's like down there sketching, right? And here comes the hippo. And Nancy's like, oh, cool. Next thing you know, and there's got to, I think there had to be a baby. This hippo comes charging and she has to get up the hill before this. And Joy Adamson's sitting there going, you'll never do that again, will you? Like,
that is not for me. The first of all, hippos are fast also. They don't look it, but they apparently, I've never seen one run, but I'm
they
told
move.
They're very fast.
They're incredibly fast. You don't be fooled by the blubber. Same
I'm
with
not.
Rhinos. Don't, we've been charged by rhinos. We've been charged by elephants. We've been charged by
God, you're lucky you're here.
Yeah, really. I mean it for a lot of things, but you learn, you know, you learn and, you know, like you say, have that healthy respect, you know, and your guides really do know the wildlife. They do. They live in it. They love them, you know, and yes, there's some that hunt subsistence hunting and stuff like that. But, you know, they understand tracking more than
they
you
do.
Know.
It's so impressive. The difference between the South Africa game drives and the Botswana ones were pretty stark. In South Africa, as I said, there were game parks. They had guns. They didn't use them, but they had guns at the jeeps. In Botswana, the guides don't have guns, which was a little unnerving at first, but in after having been in South Africa first. But when we talked to our guide, his name was Foster in Botswana, we had this one situation where our jeep stopped among a pride of lions, and the lions were curious, and they came up right up to the jeep, which is open, the Land Rover, and sat in the shade of the Land Rover, just looking up. I mean, it's like looking out your car window with the wide open. And I'm thinking, Foster doesn't have a gun. What the hell is going on here? And later, after we all could breathe again and we moved on, he cut the engine and we sat there for a long time. I asked him, how did you know that the lion wasn't going to attack? And he never takes his eyes off the eyes of the animal or the body movements. He said he could tell from the twitch of an eye or the body movement or a tremor what the lion is going to do.
Yeah.
That takes skill, research, time. And I was in absolute awe of him.
And the fact that he lay down, that was like, I'm just chilling out in the shade. And they're used to, they do mess with jeeps. They know what you're doing. You know, it's their, I mean, we went through Africa without guns. And I mean, I was, you know, single mom here, you know, all over Africa, And I don't know. I feel like that can sometimes get you into more trouble. And then maybe we got out of a lot of trouble because we're women. I don't know. I don't know how we got through it all, but we did.
You did.
And it's the animals, you learn a lot really just by observing, watching their behavior, and it becomes patterns. And that's how you know to look for them at certain places, certain times, certain habitats. Well, like Gerinuk. Have you seen a Gerinuk yet? Oh
No.
my God, you need to see a Gerinuk.
I'll have to Google it
And
right
put you,
after because I don't even know what it is.
they have these really super long necks. So everything has a different place to eat of a bush. So like they eat the higher part of an acacia, whereas an impala is grazing underneath, and everybody has a different station, and they stop eating when the leaves get like, man, because the leaves don't want to be over pruned. Nature does its own job. Here we are as gardeners, we're like chop, chop, chop. Well, I have a hard time about pruning. That's not my thing. I just let it all go. Let it go. Nature knows what she's doing, but like when you're dealing with wildlife, but I think in this country, absolutely go to our parks, look at Yellowstone, look at places we have, with wildlife. And there's a respect that we need to learn even from that. You see people going out there with, seeing people try to get next to an elk, a mom and baby, try to put their baby next to him. I'm like, oh, dude, you're gonna get it. So I think there's something to be taught also about these conversations. And if you're with a guide, I think you learn about the animals, and so you have a better appreciation, and then you may not be one of those idiots.
Well, also, you see much more, at least in our case. The trackers are, they could spot a leopard from a mile away or a cheetah, something we would not see. The way you were talking earlier about people walking by a fawn and a deer when it's 3 feet away from them. The one of the many things that's great about having a guide, which I would highly recommend for anyone, especially their first time going to Africa, you're going to get so much more out of it. You're going to see much more and you're going to feel safer
And
for
they're
sure.
so nice. They're so nice. You get to learn what Africa's like,
Yes,
you
absolutely.
really, and they become friends. They really do. There's a it's a an immersion, in a way,
The real
getting to know them.
community. I still keep in touch with our guide from Uganda, and I do every once in a while try to find our wonderful guide from Botswana. But all of our guides have been, even from our very first trip 20 years ago in Tanzania, I'll just never forget it.
That's awesome. Now, okay, before you go, I want to know about food. What did you enjoy eating in Africa? You've got to go to Morocco down to South Africa. We got wine, number one in South Africa.
Well, I mean, starting from, we love all food. We're big foodies. We often will book a restaurant before we even book our flights if there's some great restaurant we want to try. So, for instance, when we went to South Africa, there was a restaurant called the Test Kitchen that we really wanted to try in Cape Town. We made sure we got a reservation there. And that was definitely a more high-end restaurant. But everything from having a braai, which like a roast, traditional African roast to we've tried ostrich, we've tried zebra, we've tried, I mean, when we say venison here in the US, we think deer. When you say venison in Africa, it could be any number of it could, I guess, zebra
It's
included,
a lot of
impala.
impala, mostly impala,
We
Indian kudu.
I think we may have tried crocodile. Does that make sense? We tried everything. We went out to the vineyards and had lovely meals outside. And then when we were in Morocco, we would have rooftop restaurants that
Oh,
had
wow.
like mezze style overlooking the souks.
Did you have the mint tea?
Yes, we went out to the Atlas Mountains
Oh.
and went to a Berber village and had a traditional
No
mint
way, that's cool.
ceremony. We could There's no cars there. We had to hike for a few hours. It's just there's so much. I mean, hiking on it is its own whole category, whether in the Atlas Mountains or even in Uganda when you're getting to the Silverbacks. There's a lot of activity that is highly active, involved, where you're burning calories in a great way and earning your meals.
Yeah, it's hiking is the best. there's nothing like a good hike. There just isn't. And hiking in Africa to me is amazing. I mean, we got ourselves in a lot of trouble in some hikes. Like really, we ended up in different countries sometimes by accident and not knowing where we were. Like we had a farmer pick us up, put in the back of his bucky, and he's like, "You girls shouldn't be here." And we're like, "Where are we?" You know, it's awesome in South Africa. I know when you were in the Cape area, you got to see some of the proteas and the little pincushions. And did you see the sugar birds when you were out there? And
No.
and penguins. You
We
saw
saw the
penguins in
penguins. We went to Boulder
Dahuk.
Beach.
Okay, Boulder Beach. That's all Dahuk area. It's, I
There's
mean,
so much to see.
and when we were in South Africa and we worked in tourism, you know, especially with Nancy's magazine, and we actually traveled the country for 2 years with her artwork and went every single place in South Africa that you can imagine. And the tourism slogan then was South Africa is a world in one country. And I really believe that because, I mean, you've got good wine. We've seen ostrich walk the beach in Paternoster. You know, you can go up to Namibia and see lions on the beach. I mean, it's crazy, you know?
It is.
So I don't know if they, is it? Yeah, it is Namibia. One time it was Southwest Africa. Now I'm all like messed up, but anyway, it's awesome. I'm so glad you experienced it. How are you enjoying being a member of IFTWA, the International Food Wine Travel Writers Association?
I love it. I keep up with it as much as possible. I'm always reading it. I'm thrilled to be a member. And
Cool.
I'm really grateful because that's how I met you. And
I know, we're cool. And we get to meet you and have this awesome conversation about Africa, you know?
it is. It is. In fact, now I'm just sort of so jazzed by all this. I just might have to just start doing some research into possibly
Another
Namibia.
trip.
You just
Oh
piqued
yeah,
my
Namibia.
interest.
I know I want to do the Botswana, the Okavango swamp, you know,
Well, we
and
can swap
Etosha.
information.
Cool. Let's do it. Let's just go on a trek. I feel like we need to all go travel now.
I know.
I think our job is done.
I agree. I agree. I know I want to go.
I want to go. Everyone, follow Jamie and her adventures. She's on Instagram as well as I Am Lost and Found. I love that name. But go to her site, IamLostAndFound.com. You'll see a lot of her articles on Africa, under the food and lodging section, under the travel section, and around the world, Antarctica, you name it, even the Blue Ridge Mountains where we are right now. So check it out. And also, we want to thank our friends, the International Food Wine Travel Writers Association. They just finished up their big annual conference, which was a cruise from British Columbia down to LA with the Discovery Princess cruise line, which was awesome. Keep up with them at ifwtwa.org. And of course, Big Blend Radio, we air every single day, sometimes 2 to 3 shows a day because we're a little crazy. So keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Me too.